Hey, it's Jen. Just a quick heads up before we start the show. The news is rapidly developing and things may have changed by the time you hear this episode. For the latest news, tune into your public radio station and follow updates at npr.org.
This is 1A. I'm Celeste Headley in Washington, sitting in for Jen White. It's time for the news roundup. After weeks of gridlock, the Senate Democrats are finally coming away with a few wins. Juneteenth easily became a federal holiday, and it looks like President Joe Biden's jobs plan will become a reality. Meanwhile, DACA marks an anniversary. The Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Act is turning 9. And though vaccinations in the U.S. are up, the coronavirus death toll has hit another sad milestone. First, though, President Biden is back after his first trip abroad as commander-in-chief. And joining us to talk about that trip and his highly anticipated meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin is Molly Ball. She's a national political correspondent for Time and also political analyst for CNN. Great to have you back, Molly.
Great to be here. Thank you.
We're also joined by Eva McKend. She's a congressional correspondent for Spectrum News. It's good to have you as well, Eva.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with President Biden and his European trip this week, his first international trip as president. Molly, what did you come away with? What were your big sort of takeaways?
Well, it was clear that the president was trying to send a message to the world with all aspects of this trip, right? It was sort of a grand tour that took in two separate international summits, at both of which there was a message being sent of solidarity between nations, between democracies in particular, and of normalcy, right? That's what President Biden ran on in domestic and international relations. But this is someone who was the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee in the Senate, has always been very focused on international affairs and did a lot of this work as vice president as well. So he had always pledged to go back and reassure our allies that, in his words, the United States is back. And so going into the Putin meeting, it was clear that this was going to be, a 180-degree reversal of that notorious Helsinki summit between President Trump and Vladimir Putin, which Trump's critics described as this sort of unsavory love fest. And so Biden clearly wanted to show that we're taking a harder line against Russia. These are not our friends. But he also lowered expectations very aggressively, right? Because a big part of his this normalcy that he's trying to project is about pragmatism rather than taking some sort of, grand ideological template to the world.
Even since we brought up the former president, we went from Barack Obama, who was highly liked internationally, to President Trump, who didn't have the greatest relationship with a lot of leaders in Europe. So how is that sort of history of the past two U.S. presidents impacting the way Biden is either welcomed or not?
It certainly was a factor. I think actually Vladimir Putin might have put it best when he described President Biden as an experienced statesman, but people were definitely judging President Biden through the lens of his predecessors. I think it's hard to measure the immediate impact of an international trip like this, of this scale, where there is so much on the line. And I do generally feel as though in these meetings, it always feels like the American president has a lot more to lose. President Biden had a tall task before him. But I think that certainly the White House feels as though they did come away achieving on some deliverables.
Well, Wednesday, Biden met with Russian President Vladimir Putin during that summit in Geneva.
President Putin and I had share a unique responsibility to manage the relationship between two powerful and proud countries, a relationship that has to be stable and predictable. And we should be able to cooperate where it's in our mutual interest. And where we have differences, I want President Putin to understand why I say what I say and why I do what I do and how we'll respond to specific kinds of actions that harm America's interest. Now, I told President Putin my agenda is not against Russia or anyone else. It's for the American people.
So, Molly, President Biden held a briefing after that meeting with Putin and said he did what he came to do. What does that mean?
Well, I think it is, again, all about sending this message that, America is back, that our traditional alliances are being bolstered, and our traditional antagonisms are also coming back, that, you know, we are going to take a harder line against some of the actions by Russia and countries like China on issues like human rights. But the question is, you know, is he facing a different landscape now because of Trump? Is there less willingness for our allies to trust the United States? Is there less willingness to go along with an American president who's saying these things because that trust has been dissolved by this, you know, this sort of whiplash that the rest of the world has experienced in the dramatically different approaches taken, as you said, by the last two presidents. So I think for the rest of the world, this is there's going to be a bit of time taken to repair these relationships. It's not going to all happen at once.
Eva, do we know what Putin and Biden discussed?
Well, we know that President Biden said that he gave Putin a list of American entities that were absolutely could not be attacked. Energy, water, healthcare, really cybersecurity was a main issue there. And we know that Biden called the meeting because he was concerned about Russian aggression toward Ukraine. We will have to see if the message was received. I think the entire event will allow Putin to go back to Russia and give the impression that he's on the same footing as Biden. He'll try to certainly make the argument that the leaders are equal. Putin denied Russian involvement in cyber attacks, and he also refused to give any ground on the imprisoned opposition leader, Alexei Navalny. But these were all issues that Biden tried to raise, and we'll have to see in the coming weeks and months if there's going to be any change there.
This week, the Biden administration also laid out plans on how to combat domestic extremism as we move forward. It's a 32-page plan that calls for increased screening of federal employees and information sharing between both the government and some private tech companies. So, Molly, this feels like a shift, at least when it comes to the U.S. government, in that we have often gotten plans in the past on how to fight foreign terrorism. What has changed here?
Well, what has changed is the president. Yet again, this is yet another area in which we heard, in fact, in his inaugural address, President Biden, and if you recall, right back in January, coming in the immediate shadow of the Capitol attack, there was a lot of urgency to reorient the priorities of particularly federal law enforcement. But it's a very contentious area. And in the past, we have seen presidents have to tread very carefully. And, you know, presidents and their agencies, you know, the Department of Justice and so on. So it does matter what the priorities are declared to be. So when you have an administration saying they're going to make it this a priority, that simple declaration matters a lot in terms of just the message that it sends to the agencies. But of course, the devil is always in the details in terms of how exactly they're going to go after this problem and how they're going to define the shape of the problem and who exactly they're going to try to focus their efforts on.
And so, Eva, what are some of those details? I mean, we've got 32 pages of a plan that essentially is going to focus law enforcement sites on U.S. soil. Are there differences in this plan in terms of law enforcement approaches other than just the targets?
Yeah, I think key to this plan is that they want to see, they've outlined as a priority more information sharing between the government and tech sector and among law enforcement agencies. They've also made it really clear what they view as the most lethal elements of domestic terrorism today. So outlined in this report, racially or ethnically motivated violent extremists who advocate for the superiority of the white race and anti-government or anti-authority violent extremists. Something that I thought was particularly interesting is that they suggested that there is an importance in getting into communities where there is the potential for radicalization and stopping it before it becomes a problem. I'm interested to see how that is actually executed.
Yeah, I mean, we saw some shadows of that in terms of Muslim communities in the U.S. Tuesday was the 9th anniversary of the Obama-era Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. It's normally called DACA. And our Vice President Kamala Harris met with members of the National Domestic Workers Alliance.
We are here on this day, on the anniversary of DACA, and I'm here on behalf of the Biden-Harris administration to tell you this administration fully intends to do everything in our power to protect our dreamers. There will be no question about that. There is no question about that.
So, Molly, I wonder if briefly you could give us an overview of where the immigration plans stand for the Biden administration.
I think it's fair to say that despite what the vice president said there, any effort of immigration reform is quite stalled. And this is a familiar dynamic to advocates for immigration reform. And particularly given that it's clear that the administration's priorities lie elsewhere, I don't think anyone's holding their breath.
It's the News Roundup. We'll be back with the biggest domestic headlines of the week.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Jo knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A. Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Jo knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A.
What happens after a police officer shoots someone who's unarmed? For decades in California, internal affairs investigations, how the police themselves, were secret. Until now. Listen to On Our Watch, a podcast from NPR and KQED.
Now let's get back to the News Roundup. So let's talk a little more politics. Senate Democrats will start a process to pass a massive infrastructure bill, and they're planning to pass it without Republican support.
Tomorrow, I'm convening a meeting with all 11 Democratic members of the Senate Budget Committee regarding a fiscal year 22 budget resolution. And now that President Biden's fiscal 22 budget request has been received by Congress, the Budget Committee can begin the important work of producing a budget resolution, especially with respect to the Jobs and Family Plan. As you know, a budget resolution will outline how we go forward and includes issues that are affected, that are part of reconciliation.
That was Majority Leader Chuck Schumer on Wednesday during a press conference. So, Molly, can you translate that from Politico speech into normal person speech? What did Schumer just say?
It's always a translation practice, isn't it?
It is.
Well, look, there's still a lot up in the air in the Senate about how this is all going to work, and it's very much a live issue. We are still waiting to hear what the White House thinks of the bipartisan infrastructure talks that went on while the president was out of the country. The president has a big decision to make about whether he supports that framework and as part of the two-track strategy that has the infrastructure piece that could be bipartisan, paired with this massive reconciliation bill that can pass with 51 votes. The problem for the Democrats is they don't yet have 50 votes lined up behind the massive reconciliation package. And because it's going to be the big deal bill for all of the Democrats' priorities, it's turning into a bit of a kitchen sink, you know, with different senators wanting to put different things into it, to the point that they're talking now about as much as $6 trillion
huge.
In spending, which is a lot of money, even for me, and even for Congress. So I think there is a lot of road to travel before we have any idea how big this thing is going to be or what exactly is going to be in it.
And whether they'll meet the deadline for fiscal 2022 in July is another big question. But even before we pass on from this, because it can be a little confusing, all the things that are happening, is there a quick way to sort of sort through the infrastructure bill, the American Families Plan, the American Jobs Plan?
A quick way. I don't know. I will say this, that it is a lot of spending. And, you know, Senator Schumer at this point is saying, yes, it's all well and good that the 20 bipartisan lawmakers are still trying to work out a deal on hard infrastructure. So roads, bridges, broadband, that's all well and good. But they're not going to get played here. Yeah. That they need to start creating a procedural mechanism to make this happen on their own if things fall apart.
Okay, so let's talk about the Judiciary Committee. That's at least the one in the House led by the Democrats. That committee will start investigations into efforts made during the Trump administration by the Justice Department to seize data related to journalists and lawmakers, including Democratic Representatives Adam Schiff and Eric Swalwell. Molly, can you remind us what exactly is the Trump administration DOJ accused of?
Well, we really don't know a lot of the details here, and that is part of what is so perplexing about this story. Lawmakers, their family members, even President Trump's own White House counsel, Don McGahn, have only just now been notified that these subpoenas were issued way back in 2018 for all kinds of people who are not traditionally targeted by the Justice Department. This is quite a taboo, and they don't really know exactly what these investigations were about. I should mention journalists also have now found out that their phone and email records were subpoenaed. We don't really know who at the Justice Department was behind this push, which leaks in particular they were going after, and who authorized it, and how this was allowed to happen, given that it is such a violation of the traditional norms around these types of investigations. So I think, you know, we've only got the tip of the iceberg so far, but I think in the broader sense, this and the other DOJ revelations that are coming out from the other end of the administration, the late hours of 2020, are all, I think, painting a picture of a Trump administration whose scandals are not yet done wrapping Washington around an axle. We're still going to be dealing with the investigations, the fallout, the revelations. If you thought that, you know, the sort of mile a minute dynamic of the Trump era news cycle was over and done with, there's still a drip of news still to come out of it.
Yeah, it's going to be a little bit like following an episode of 24, right? Let's talk about a bill that has passed through Congress, and that was a bill that makes Juneteenth, that is the day that marks the end of slavery, at least when it was announced in one of our states, a federal holiday. President Biden signed that bill on Thursday afternoon. So, Eva, this is the first new federal holiday since I was in high school, since Martin Luther King Jr. Day was created. Was I in high school? Maybe junior high. Was created in 1983. How significant do you think this is? How big of a deal is this?
I think it's major. As you mentioned, the first new federal holiday in 40 years. Juneteenth now becomes the 12th federal holiday in this country. I think everyone is still trying to catch their breath by how quickly it happened.
Yeah.
I think maybe Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer was strategic in kind of keeping this quiet, keeping this under wraps, because it didn't allow for a lot of time for there to be a real opposition towards it. He knew he had the 60 votes in the Senate, and he said, let's make it happen this week. And there's perhaps no one more thrilled on Capitol Hill than Sheila Jackson Lee, Congresswoman from Texas, who described this as a legislative miracle.
There has been a little bit of backlash, although I was surprised only 14 House members voted against it. There was an overwhelming majority voting in favor in the House. And yet, Molly, we have this odd thing happening on the state level. I want to read you this tweet that came from Monique Judge, who's the news editor for The Root. Monique tweeted, "Imagine making Juneteenth a federal holiday when laws are being enacted all over the country that will prevent people from being taught why it's a holiday. I mean, it's an incredible disconnect here. How are we to sort of put this in context politically?
Well, it comes at a time when I think the same dynamics and factors that caused this holiday to be enacted are also causing, it's because these issues of racial equality, racial equity, and racial education and our history have become so salient in the past year since the murder of George Floyd. We saw, and this was something that had been building for a long time, right? In the same way that people like Sheila Jackson Lee have been pushing for this holiday for years and years and years, and that is what allowed it to be pushed through at the drop of a hat once the people who could give it the green light did so. In the same way, there had been, you know, there was a Black Lives Matter movement before George Floyd was killed. A lot of these changes had been percolating slowly, and then we saw them simply get supercharged by the massive racial awakening that happened last year with the protest movement. So these things are happening very quickly, and there has been a backlash at the state level. You have a national movement on the right to root out what they are calling the scourge of critical race theory in education, bills in multiple states of questionable constitutionality, trying to dictate curriculum and push back on what they call a sort of anti-American trend in this type of discourse. But I think what you see with Juneteenth is there is, although there are some objections, there is something to like for everyone because it is a way of celebrating racial progress. It's a way of saying, for particularly for people on the right who say, you know, let's not badmouth America. This is a way of saying, look, here's a time when progress was made. Here's a time when, you know, the Emancipation Proclamation was signed. It took years for it to actually have an effect in terms of enslaved people being freed.
Right. I don't want to interrupt you, Molly.
So here's something we can celebrate.
I have to ask, let me put this to you. It is an odd thing for a person of color to take in at this moment, right? How are we to determine what state of progress the country is in, right? Juneteenth passed, I think, easier than many people expected. And yet, at the same time, as Monique Judge pointed out, there is this huge resistance to even learning the history of America's racist past and the history of chattel slavery. How are you sort of weighing all of this?
I think for so many, it really is bittersweet. It comes at a time when conservatives are raging against critical race theory, and that has become sort of a catch-all phrase for talking about race, period, in school and having conversations about systemic racism. So I think everyone is still trying to grapple with what exactly does this mean. Yes, Juneteenth, but it's not undergirded by police reform or prison reform or an examination of voting rights or any of the systemic issues that we face in this country. And so I think the best way that I think a lot of people will feel about it is bittersweet. We want to give Opal Lee her flowers, a 94-year-old woman who walked from Fort Worth to D.C. for years to make this happen. I don't think she walked the entire way, but some of the way. And so we want to thank Opal. We don't want to diminish her sacrifice and all that she did for years to raise awareness about Juneteenth and all of the others who did this. But we also have to take a step back and recognize it, that this ain't everything, that there is still a lot to be desired.
Yeah, one listener emails, I think it's a matter of high hypocrisy for members of Congress to vote against the For the People Act, yet vote for a Juneteenth holiday. The For the People Act is to reform voting. I wanted to put one last question on this Juneteenth holiday to you, Molly. And it is a question from Jessica via email, who says, what is a white person's role in celebrating Juneteenth?
I think that's a really interesting question, and that is something that has yet to be determined, right? This is literally the first time it's been a national holiday. And so, you know, I think I suspect that where we end up is something like Memorial Day, where it's a mix of the somber and the celebratory. Memorial Day, a day that when we remember with sadness the sacrifices that have been made, but it's also not taboo to get together and have a barbecue and enjoy your day off of work.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think the hope, particularly for proponents of this holiday, is that in celebrating and in enjoying that day off of work, which nobody's against, we are also prompted to reflect in a somber way on what exactly it is we are celebrating, the work that still has to be done, the progress that still has to be made. So it's a teaching moment, right? Because a big part of it also is increasing people's awareness of our history.
Yeah.
And it's also an opportunity for reflection.
And it's a summer holiday that is focused on the history, especially of Black Americans, which means the playlist will be lit and the food is going to be awesome. And let's get another voice into this conversation. Julie Appleby is a senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Welcome, Julie.
Well, thanks for having me.
In COVID-related news, more U.S. cities are now lifting restrictions as more of the population gets vaccinated. In California and in New York particularly, businesses can now operate at 100% capacity, and 70% of adults in New York have had at least one dose of the vaccine. So, Julie, what are things like, especially in these places where restrictions have just been lifted?
You know, it's been quite a week, hasn't it? We've sort of seen this mix of good news and bad. So, in New York and in California, where more than 70% of adults have received at least one dose, they're on kind of one end of the spectrum, and they've lifted a lot of the restrictions. For example, in New York, you know, restaurants are no longer going to have to space tables 6 feet apart, and movie theaters can, you know, be full. California has lifted their mask mandates. In fact, they just came out yesterday and said fully vaccinated workers don't have to wear their masks at work. So things are changing in those states. But then we've also got some states where the vaccination rates are still quite low. And
we're going to talk about that in just a second. I wonder, Julie, though, if we know if it's too soon. How do we know that?
That's the question. That's what everybody's going to see going forward, right? Public health officials have said that 70%, 80% is probably a pretty good number, but everybody's going to be watching this. And cases are fairly low right now. Unfortunately, we just passed this really grim milestone as a country with 600,000 deaths, right? But at the same time, cases and deaths are at their lowest level since the start of the pandemic. So we'll have to keep an eye on New York and California, but also these states where the vaccination rates are not as high.
Well, let's talk about that. Many of those states are in the South. Experts are very worried that we'll see surges of COVID-19 in places like Alabama, Louisiana, Mississippi. Those are places where less than half of the population has gotten even a single dose of the vaccine. So we go from 70% vaccination in New York to 40% or lower in places like Alabama. Can we explain all of this with vaccine hesitancy?
You know, I think it's really hard to explain. I think part of it certainly is vaccine hesitancy. I'm reading, though, that also a lot of folks are still saying that they're finding it difficult to access the vaccine, not because there's a shortage, but maybe because they can't get time off work or they can't travel to get it. But hesitancy is a big part of it, as is, in some cases, lack of trust in government. And I think that's going to be the part that's hardest to overcome for some of these states.
Molly, Biden's goal of 70% vaccination by July 4th, that is still the goal. Has the federal government said anything about plans to bring some of these other states like Alabama and Louisiana up to the higher average?
Well, yes and no. There is an aggressive push being made to encourage people to get vaccinated and ensure that the vaccines are available for everybody. And we have heard a consistent drumbeat from the administration, from the CDC, and they are finding more and more creative ways. We also see states finding more creative ways, things like lotteries, different incentives, businesses also looking for different ways that they can incentivize this. And I think the hope at this point is that there's no silver bullet, but it will just gradually, that number will continue to go up.
Yeah, I saw one place offering beer if you get your vaccination. We'll hear more from you and our guests in a moment.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Hint, fruit-infused water with no calories or sweeteners. Hint water comes in over 25 flavors. The watermelon water actually tastes like watermelon. The blackberry water tastes like blackberries. Hint is water with a touch of true fruit flavor. You can get Hint water at stores, or you can have it delivered directly to your door. When you buy two cases, you'll get a third case free and free shipping. Visit drinkhint.com and use promo code NPR at checkout.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Jo knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult.
You're listening to the News Roundup. Now let's jump back into the conversation. Let's talk about those who don't want to take the vaccine, and that brings us to Houston, Texas. Hundreds of hospital workers there sued their employer over a requirement that they be fully vaccinated before returning to work. And on Saturday, a federal judge dismissed that lawsuit. Julie, under what grounds was the lawsuit dismissed? What did the judge say?
You know, the judge said that he rejected it, saying that the claims that the vaccine is experimental and dangerous is, as he said, false and also irrelevant. He said that the requirement by Houston Methodist that their employees be vaccinated does not violate state or federal law or public policy. And said, you know, basically just dismissed it. The judge also had some harsh things to say to the plaintiffs for comparing the vaccine mandate to experiments by the Nazis against Jewish people during the Holocaust. So the judge was not pleased about that. So the judge rejected that. Now, again, this was based on Texas law, so the precedent in other states may be a little bit different, but the EEOC has come out and said that employers can require vaccination.
That's the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. And yet, after the case was dismissed, the attorney representing the plaintiffs, the hospital workers, said, this is the first battle in a long fight. What do you think he's right, Julie? Are we going to see a lot of other cases like this?
Well, they're certainly going to appeal, it sounds like. And I think we will see some other cases. And again, it may vary state by state. But there's precedent here. I mean, employers can require you to get an influenza vaccine or Hep B vaccine. We see this most often in healthcare settings, but it could be other settings. So I think we may see some more cases. But keep in mind also, though, that a lot of employers are very hesitant to require vaccination. In fact, there was a survey out just this week from a consulting firm that found that 72% of employers say that they won't require vaccination.
Wow.
But they would give time off to folks or other incentives to try to get them to go get vaccinated, but they're not going to require it. And think about it, in healthcare setting, this is particularly problematic for, say, nursing home owners. I mean, it's really important, right, for the workers to be vaccinated. But at the same time, if you put in a mandate and several of your staff or half your staff quits over this, then you've got a problem. So I think that's what employers are trying to weigh here.
And we still don't entirely know the origins of the coronavirus, but it is something that is hotly debated. There is this idea that it originated in a Wuhan lab. That's also known as the lab leak theory. And that's actually been gaining some steam lately. Two House Republicans introduced a bill Tuesday that would actually sanction Chinese health officials unless and until they allow a full investigation into that theory. Webb writes on Facebook, the investigation needs to be in Wuhan. It's quite doubtful the Chinese will allow a complete investigation to occur by non-Chinese scientists. And then Pete also writes on Facebook about this lab leak investigation. This somehow seems un-American, quick to assign blame and criminalize without due process. So there's even a difference of opinion in social media debates. Molly, the lab leak theory has been around since the beginning. Why is it gaining traction right now?
Well, this is a debate that became very polarized and politicized in ways that don't really make sense, honestly. There is, but it has gotten conflict. Well, and the reason we're talking about it now, to your point, is that there has now been increasing potential evidence for the so-called lab leak theory that has caused people to go back and reexamine it and caused the White House to order the intelligence community to take a look at all of the evidence here. But at the beginning, this theory got conflated with the idea that this was something that China intentionally did, that it was some sort of weapon or something like that. that. And that is not something that most experts take seriously at all. But it was used as a talking point, particularly for President Trump when he was trying to blame China for the virus and position himself as the victim of foreign malfeasance. But, you know, whether it leaked from a lab or came from a market, in both of those situations, this wasn't something anybody intended. The point is just, how can we, you know, prevent it from happening again and ensure that whatever research is being done safely?
So, Eva, the Biden administration is, you know, calling for investigations, hoping to get more information about the lab leak theory. And yet this is still seems very partisan to me. Why is this idea of a lab leak so polarized?
Well, because Republicans have been suggesting this theory for a long time. And right now, they really feel vindicated because they've been saying this for months. New York Congresswoman Elise Stefanik, she is the one that has introduced the World Deserves to Know Act to really have a more investigation about, as questions remain about where the virus originated. That's not a rank and file member of Congress. She's in the leadership. So that shows just how significant this issue is to so many congressional Republicans at not only laying the blame at China, but arguing that they were the one to make this argument first and they should be credited for that.
So then what exactly, Julie, do we know about the origins of the coronavirus for sure?
I don't think there's an answer to that question. I don't think we know for sure whether it did come from an animal or whether it did come from a lab that sent somehow maybe somebody there got sick and it got out that way. I think that's the big question. And whether or not we ever get a definitive answer for that, I think is also uncertain.
Huh. I mean, there's a lot of theories going around, but Molly, I'm just interested to know whether you think politically this would hurt the Biden administration or the Democrats in any way if it turned out there was a lab leak.
I think it would be hurtful if they had positioned themselves in opposition to this theory. But the fact that the administration has gone out of its way to admit this possibility and to try to find out. But, you know, it is possible that we never know the origin. And I think that's frustrating for a lot of people. But it is very commonly the case in diseases like this, whether they become a pandemic or not, that the origins remain mysterious simply because nature is mysterious and we have to accept that.
I don't want to accept it, Molly. In any case, before we move on from health, a non-COVID story, three FDA advisors resigned last week. That's after the agency approved a controversial Alzheimer's drug that the advisors say could be dangerous. Julie, what is the story here?
Yeah, isn't this interesting? The FDA did just recently approve a new Alzheimer's drug. It's the first new drug for this condition in almost 20 years. And the controversy is over whether or not there was enough evidence to show that it worked. So three experts from this advisory panel have since resigned. They say that they felt that there wasn't enough evidence to move this forward, but the FDA did go ahead and approve it in a way that concerned them. So the drug is a monoclonal antibody. It targets this thing called beta amyloid protein that can cause these plaques in your brain, and it does remove some of those plaques. The question is, does removing those plaques improve or help slow memory loss? And that's the point of the drug, but it was approved based on its ability to remove these plaques. And these panel members felt that there wasn't enough evidence that it worked, and there's some side effects with this drug. It can cause brain swelling and or bleeding. So those were some of the concerns. And there's a bigger issue. Another issue here is that it's a very expensive drug. Biogen said they're going to price it at about $56,000 a year, and that's just for the drug. It's an intravenous drug.
How?
And because of this brain swelling problem, folks who take it are going to have these expensive imaging tests to make sure that they're not having problems. So this is not going to be inexpensive. So this is raising a lot of concern about what is going to be the cost if indeed a lot of folks take this. And that's another part, and this is very complicated. Another part of the controversy over this is the FDA approved this rather broadly, basically said anybody with Alzheimer's practically could be eligible for this rather than just maybe somebody with early stage. And so we're talking 6 million people could potentially be eligible for a drug that costs $56,000 a year.
And Dawn tweets this, please use a light touch with Alzheimer's families and friends. We get all kinds of cures, hacks, and fixes pointed at us. It's draining and agonizing. We live with the sinking feeling that we're not doing enough to help, that we're making mistakes. Julie Appleby is senior correspondent at Kaiser Health News. Thank you so much, Julie. I want to turn to two major rulings that came out of the Supreme Court this week. First, Thursday, the court voted 7-2 to uphold the Affordable Care Act. Molly, how often now has the Supreme Court upheld the ACA?
Only 3 times.
Is that all?
It feels like this happens every couple of months, right? Because it has been such
a drumbeat.
But we do think that this is probably the last time that the creativity of the conservative legal movement has been exhausted in its attempt.
That's what you guys said last time.
Maybe I didn't, but I'm saying it again. In any case, but I think there is in the political sphere. I think it actually happened back when the Republicans failed to repeal Obamacare. A few years ago, it set in this sort of acceptance that Obamacare is the law of the land, and Obamacare is here to stay. And this challenge was a sort of Hail Mary, if you will. But based on the oral arguments a few months ago, I think nobody really expected that the court was going to rule any other way.
So, talk about whiplash here. The difference of opinion between the last administration to the ACA and President Biden. Is broad, not surprisingly, since President Biden was vice president when the ACA was passed. But Biden wants to build on the Affordable Care Act. And do you think that will be difficult to do, considering Republican opposition?
Absolutely. I mean, anything that isn't narrowly pertaining to spending or something that can get through budget reconciliation process, the narrow process that doesn't require 60 votes in the Senate, I think is going to be a tall order. Whether it's health care or immigration or climate change, Democrats can try to get as creative as they want, but it's going to be very, very difficult to get these more substantive, progressive policy desires through Congress without 10 votes in the Senate and without the elimination of the filibuster.
I wonder, Eva, if you agree with Molly that at this point the conservative side is resigned.
I do. I saw a statement from House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy that I think really indicates that this is the end of the road, that they are not going to challenge this again legally. I guess never say never.
Yeah.
But I think that at this point, they have exhausted so many channels, you know, not only in the Supreme Court, but through Congress. They couldn't even get rid of the ACA when they had the House, the Senate, and the White House. So I think that this is the end, but we shall see.
So another Supreme Court decision announced on Thursday, the SCOTUS ruled unanimously in favor of a Catholic foster care agency that refused to work with same-sex couples. I wonder, Eva, if you can tell us a little bit more about the details of this.
Yeah, so it was a Catholic Social Services Agency in Philly. The Supreme Court decided that they could defy city rules and refuse to work with same-sex couples who apply to take in foster children. The Supreme Court actually ruled unanimously, which was kind of remarkable given the makeup of this court, the 6-3 conservative majority on the court. But it seems as though the left-leaning justices on the court decided that it was, it almost seems like a strategic decision to do this, that maybe if they sided with their colleagues, then they wouldn't get into a larger conversation about this decision. And they sort of just ruled on a very limited aspect of this. I will say that there is disappointment from the LGBTQ community. I'm seeing just this morning that Congressman Sean Patrick Maloney of New York is tweeting, as a gay father, this reflecting this Father's Day, there shouldn't be this effort to block block us from being able to foster and adopt and take care of children that you shouldn't be prevented from doing so just because you are a member of the queer community.
I mean, especially because there's actually a large number of kids who never get adopted, who age out of the foster care system. And I wonder, Molly, what happens now? As Eva said, it was very narrowly defined, this decision. Does that mean it will not have a real impact on nationwide in terms of other cases, other foster care agencies and even state agencies?
Well, that is the assertion made by the conservatives on the court, some of whom wrote rather scathing concurrences with this decision. And I think, as Eva pointed out, the real interesting part of this case is not the top line number, but the machinations we can see under the surface in this new dynamic on the court, right? Remember, we are still in the sort of first flush of cases since Judge Barrett was confirmed back last October. And so this is a new dynamic for the court, this 6-3 conservative majority. And what we are seeing is it is not so much a 6-3 conservative majority as it is different factions of conservatives, some of whom would like to see the court go further. Justice Roberts, known as a very Chief Justice Roberts, known for being very cautious. And there are some conservatives on the court who would like to see him be less so.
Molly Ball is a Time national political correspondent and political analyst at CNN. Eva McCand is a congressional correspondent at Spectrum News. You're listening to the News Roundup. We'll discuss the week's biggest headlines from around the world in just a moment. This is 1A.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Kay Buxbaum in support of the David Gilkey and Zabiula Tamana Memorial Fund, established to strengthen NPR's commitment to training and protecting journalists in high-risk environments. Support for NPR comes from Newman's Own Foundation, working to nourish the common good by donating all profits from Newman's Own food products to charitable organizations that seek to make the world a better place. More information is available at newmansownfoundation.org.
There is a lot to talk about on the Global News Roundup this week. President Biden's meeting with President Putin was less a reset moment and more how to reframe what the United States can expect from the Russian leader. There's change at the top in Israel. Iran goes to the polls, and North Korea's leader sounds the alarm over whether the hermit kingdom has enough food to feed its people. Joining us this week from the Washington Post and just back from Europe, where she's been reporting on the president's trip this week, we have Anne Guerin. Anne is a White House correspondent with a focus on foreign policy and national security, looking more alert than she deserves to be. Anne, always a pleasure.
Happy to be here.
Jennifer Williams is the senior foreign editor of Vox. She's also the co-host of Vox's foreign affairs podcast, Worldly. Welcome back, Jennifer.
Always a pleasure.
And David Rennie is the Beijing bureau chief for The Economist. Hi, David.
Hi there.
Let's begin in Geneva.
We'll find out within the next 6 months to a year whether or not we actually have a strategic dialogue that matters. I said, your generation and mine are about 10 years apart. This is not a kumbaya moment, as you used to say back in the 60s in the United States, like, let's hug and love each other.
That was President Biden speaking to reporters on the final day of his week-long tour, and you were there. We heard a lot from President Biden and from President Putin. What stood out for you?
Well, Celeste, I think what you heard the president doing there was giving his victory lap after the summit with Putin in Geneva, something that Putin had just completed doing himself, rather than a side-by-side news conference where they reporters could ask the same question to each of them. They did their wrap-up news conferences sequentially. I think what stood out to me about the summit itself is that it happened, and it happened in a pretty orderly fashion. It ran a little shorter than many U.S. officials had been predicting, a lot shorter than a lot of reporters had been predicting, given Putin's habit of showing up late and running long. Neither of those things happened. It was a pretty businesslike exchange, from the U.S. perspective, Biden went in and said his piece. As he said afterwards, he did what he came to do, ran down a list of complaints about Russian behavior. The meeting was too short for them to actually have a great deal of discussion about those complaints, but the U.S. is declaring victory in that it was able to run through that list, make sure that Putin heard them, and then move on.
So, Jen, these two have a history with each other. They've never particularly liked one another, if we are to, you know, believe reporting. Was there respect? Do we think they can work together?
Yeah, I think there's definitely respect. You know, Biden afterwards said that he, you know, considers Putin to be a worthy adversary, which is, you know, quite
interesting,
quite telling. Yes. you know, but he did use the word adversary, to be clear. And afterward, you know, Putin also had some rather complimentary statements to say about Biden, pushing back on sort of the kind of Trump era, you know, criticisms of Biden that he's not all there, that he's too old, that he kind of is forgetful. There were some conservative media poking fun at Biden for having some notes written down. And Putin said, yeah, he looked at his notes. We all do. So it seems, you know, they do respect each other. They do understand that they are both, you know, important world leaders. But respect does not mean friendship. It doesn't mean trust. It doesn't mean anything of the sort. Biden, you know, playing off the old trust but verify line, said, you know, this is not about trust. It's about self-interest and verification of self-interest. And he was very clear-eyed about, look, I'm not looking for friendship. I'm not looking for both of us to agree. We're not going to agree. But we can find areas that are in our mutual self-interest, specifically things like not attacking each other's critical infrastructure with cyber attacks, things like finding ways to work on humanitarian aid in Syria, things like strategic conversations, which mean nuclear weapons, conversations about, you know, reducing the risk of nuclear war and reducing their both sides' very substantial nuclear arsenals. So, you know, I don't think there's any expectation on Biden's part that he's going to really change Putin's behavior or Russia's behavior on the international stage, but it's really about setting kind of clear lines. Here's where each side stands, and let's see where we can cooperate going forward.
Very different, of course, from Trump's relationship, but I'm thinking back to President Bush saying, I looked the man in the eye, I found him straightforward and trustworthy and got a sense of his soul. I'm paraphrasing. And we are far from that. David, Biden has been around long enough that he has a history with a lot of world leaders. He famously said that China's president, Xi, doesn't have a democratic bone in his body. Before this meeting, Biden agreed with a reporter who said he thought Putin was a killer. So how do you think this long history in the political realm on the international stage will impact Biden's ability to get things done diplomatically?
I think when the president said that he was hoping to look for self-interest on both sides, that's a very realistic and experienced man saying that the only thing that matters to Vladimir Putin, we have learned from bitter experience, is his perception of his own self-interest. And you saw really interesting comments where President Biden was almost kind of trying to explain why Russia isn't quite the foe it thinks it is. He said that Putin's economy is in real trouble, in part because of American sanctions, and that Putin isn't looking for a Cold War with the United States. And I think that part of the very strong message of this whole trip, and we'll get to the G7 stuff later, I'm sure, was this idea that America is back. And I think that to see those two men in that meeting in Geneva, you had to understand that the run-up to that from the Biden administration point of view was this was not just a meeting between the American president and the Russian president. This was the American president as the leader of the Democratic West coming out of a NATO meeting, coming out of a G7 meeting, coming out of a kind of mending of broken bridges with the Europeans. And before he left, it was interesting, Joe Biden said that his aim when he went on this tour was to make it clear to Putin and China that Europe and the United States are tight. And he kind of half succeeded. But the truth is that in that framing of kind of this is a fight between democracies or a contest of democracies versus autocracies, which President Biden is very fond of saying in the context of both Russia and China, the Europeans probably are a little bit warier of that framing than he would like.
Now, in Geneva, President Biden did not mince words when he talked about the possible consequence if opposition leader Alexei Navalny were to die in his Russian prison cell. Biden told reporters this is not a topic he dodged in his talks with Vladimir Putin.
That's just part of the DNA of our country. So human rights is going to always be on the table, I told him. It's not about just going after Russia when they violate human rights. It's about who we are.
And can you give us context for why Putin may be treating Navalny different than other political foes that he has been accused of disposing of?
Yeah, they tend to meet a bad end.
Yeah.
They get poisoned, pushed out of windows.
They jumped out of windows, Anne.
Oh, I forget.
Remember? They jumped.
Forget. Dang. That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Poisoned on park benches. So what President Biden was doing there, was saying that unlike Donald Trump, whose name he didn't use in that particular sentence, but did elsewhere in his post Putin news conference, Trump sort of dismissed the whole idea of human rights as something that the United States needed to raise with other countries. He just didn't see the point. Said a number of times that he felt like it was other countries' business to take care of and not U.S. not in U.S. interests to raise it. The clear feeling from Biden is that you're not being an American president on the world stage unless you do raise it.
Yeah.
With respect to Navalny himself, Biden made a really interesting argument, which is, hey, Vladimir Putin, if this guy dies on your watch, you are undercutting your own credibility around the world. Because you keep saying over and over again that this is an extremist movement that needs to be, that Russia needs to watch and protect itself against. But Navalny himself is just sort of a flea. He's just a little annoyance. He's nothing to worry about. That's Putin's official statement. And Biden is saying, hey, look, if you kill this guy, you're telling people you are afraid of him. And that, I think, was a very interesting point to make.
So, Jen, President Biden gave Putin some custom-made aviators during this summit, which I thought might have been interpreted as a gift, but could be interpreted as literal shade. What's your guess? I mean, what do you think the odds are that Putin will show up wearing those?
Well, Putin tends to prefer Cartier sunglasses.
It's true. It's true.
He's a very, very wealthy man, mostly through ill-gotten gains. And he likes to flash his wealth around. The aviators were, in one sense, it was kind of a chummy, hey, Biden is known for wearing his signature aviators. But it was also a very pointed and somewhat aggressive commentary because the aviators are made by Randolph USA. They are the company that makes aviators for the U.S. Air Force, for fighter pilots, and for NATO partners. So he's kind of saying, hey, when you wear these, why don't you think about all those planes that could potentially bomb your country? It wasn't exactly a friendly gift.
I hope that wasn't written in the note.
I don't know.
I don't think Hallmark makes a greeting card like that.
Right, exactly. I'm just wondering if there was any kind of bug in the sunglasses. We can maybe listen in.
Now, before that handshake in Geneva, members of the G7 gathered by the seaside in the UK. We'll talk about what came out of that meeting in just a moment. But perhaps one of the most powerful speakers they all heard from was neither a president nor a prime minister. It was an Attenborough.
Tackling climate change is now as much a political and communications challenge as it is a scientific or technological one. We have the skills to address it in time. All we need is the global will to do so.
Understanding that there is a climate summit coming in Glasgow later this year, and that is being seen as sort of the main climate event, I wonder to what extent G7 was sort of a way to set expectations for the UN climate change conference that's being called COP26. David, were there any concrete announcements, anything we heard specifically about climate?
There were some promises. Some of them were reiterations of promises made in the past that had lapsed. So, for example, the G7 nations said that they would facilitate, they would help poorer countries access $100 billion in climate finance a year to cope with the effects of climate change. We had promises, which could actually be rather tangible, about to stop funding coal-fired power stations overseas. They agreed, in many cases, they already made this promise, that they would have net carbon zero emissions by 2050. And they said that basically coal is no longer an acceptable fuel to use to generate electricity unless you have carbon capture and storage. And so they promised to phase out coal. That could be a big deal if they really mean it. But you saw some of the big environmental NGOs saying it was kind of talk, but not really enough money and not really strong commitments. But they had to say something, as you say, The UK is going to be hosting the next big climate summit, postponed because of COVID by a year. It's going to happen in Glasgow in November. And there really do have to be some very solid promises made by the big polluters, including the US.
Jen, there were some solid promises, or at least announcements made, particularly in relation to COVID. What did we hear about that?
Yeah, the G7 plus, so some of the other countries that also joined, basically agreed to provide at least 1 billion doses of COVID vaccines, particularly, as you said, to poorer countries. They'll be doing this either directly or through COVAX, that kind of broader international alliance initiative. There were some other additional kind of promises that were made that didn't get as much attention. They also are going to send, an increased funding to facilitate like domestic production of vaccines in various countries, and also send technical assistance and money to help countries distribute those vaccines. Because it's not just the number of vaccines, so that's obviously a huge thing, but it's also getting those vaccines into people's arms. So, you know, just like we've seen in the United States, where just having the vaccines themselves doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get everyone vaccinated, every other country is having that same problem. So they're going to be doing things they already have been in terms of, you know, trying to, you know, facilitate that at a more broad level. But still, when it comes to the number of vaccines, you know, the WHO has said, roughly estimated, that to get to that 70% vaccination rate, which is basically the line that experts are saying, that's when that we'll see the pandemic really start to slow down globally, they need 11 billion vaccines. And so when you think about these, you know, 1 billion doses that they've promised to donate, that's great. But if some of these are two-dose vaccines, well, that cuts it in half, right? And so just given the scale, the absolute sheer scale of the vaccination need around the world, this is a great start, but it's far from enough to actually get where we need to be globally.
Ahead of this meeting, finance ministers with the G7 met, and they laid out plans for a global tax reform deal. And I wonder, Anne, if you can tell us exactly what that plan involves and how it compares to what we heard this week in Cornwall.
Yeah, so the global minimum corporate tax is something that had been pushed by the Biden administration. The idea is to try to prevent some capital flight where companies headquarter themselves or do business in places with the least amount of corporate tax. Tax havens is another way to look at it. We're not talking here about Swiss banks where people are squirreling away money. We're talking about where companies say they are headquartering or doing business when they're actually doing business around the world. And, you know, what was agreed by finance ministers was less at 15, was significantly less than Janet Yellen, the Treasury Secretary, and others had indicated would be ideal. But the fact that the G7 finance ministers endorsed this idea at all was pretty significant.
Yeah.
It cannot be exactly enforced. I mean, the G7 is not a police force. They, yeah, you know, they can say this is what the global rules of the road should be, and they can do a little naming and shaming of corporations that don't abide by them and countries that don't abide by them. But you know, it's saying this is what we expect. This is good practice, but it's these are guidelines, not exact rules.
Before President Biden left Geneva, the area completely, he did take a little time to meet with NATO leaders in Brussels, and the Secretary General of NATO did not just single out Russia as the main threat to the world. Here is Stoltenberg speaking earlier this week.
China is rapidly expanding its nuclear arsenal with more warheads and a larger number of sophisticated delivery systems. NATO leaders called on China to uphold its international commitments and to act responsibly in the international system, in keeping with its role as a major power.
So, David, what was China's response?
China was predictably angry, talked about how in both the G7 and in NATO, the Americans are obsessed with creating small cliques which don't have any legitimacy. China has a very well-advanced story that it's pushing at the moment, that China is the legitimate upholder of an international order that thinks of all countries, including poor countries in Africa and Asia and Latin America, as equally important. and that the Americans are this declining, arrogant ex-hegemon that is clinging to a small group of Western countries and trying to still boss the world around. The problem for President Biden is that having secured that language on China from NATO, which was basically an American ask, you then saw the French president, Emmanuel Macron, turning around very shortly after the NATO summit and saying that he was very uncomfortable with the idea of an Atlantic security alliance like NATO having views on something like China. And he said, as far as I'm aware, the borders of the Atlantic don't include China. So having signed up to that deal, you can see even, you know, before the ink is dry, that Europeans are very uneasy about this new American push to form a kind of alliance of the West against China and Russia.
Let's turn to a different part of the world, shall we? Let's turn to Israel. After 12 uninterrupted years in power, Benjamin Netanyahu, who is out as prime minister, parliament voted in, they voted in a coalition government. There was a narrow margin that was led by right-wing nationalist Naftali Bennett and centrist Yair Lapid. So here's a bit of Netanyahu's final speech as prime minister, and he predicted a return.
Our achievements have transformed Israel from a peripheral force into a rising force on the world stage. This is our path, and my partners in the national camp, my camps on the genuine right. And if it is fated that we must be in opposition, we shall do so with our backs straight until we topple this dangerous government and return to lead this country in our own way.
So, Anne, how surprising was this turn of events?
Well, it was surprising in that this finally marked the end of Netanyahu's rule here the last 12 years. Remember, he had been prime minister before that as well. He's been the dominant political figure in Israel for a full political generation. So to see him exiled from power is remarkable. But at the same time, Israel has been locked in a election cycle for 2+ years that was all about the question of how do we get rid of Netanyahu? You know, he held power for so long. He held a lock on a number of issues that Israel has just not been able to get past because of him and his coalition and the exigencies that he had as a leader. Remember, he put together a coalition government that included a number of parties to his political right,
yeah,
and deeply religious parties. And then he had to make sure that those needs were taken care of or he was going to lose power. What finally did him in was a separate kind of coalition that involves a little bit of every part of the Israeli political spectrum. And for the first time, an Arab-Israeli party is part of the governing coalition. These are things that have never happened in Israel before. But that's what it took to finally end the Netanyahu era, was, you know, a collection of every other kind of
pretty much everybody,
force.
Not yeah. Netanyahu against everyone else. And there are questions about whether this will be a graceful transition. Are there not? Why is that question coming up?
Yeah, I mean, before he actually left, and remember, he's not leaving. He's going into opposition. The way the Israeli
right.
system works is you're either in the governing man on top, or you are the opposition on the bottom. So we
right, majority, minority here. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, he now he's the guy who's trying to get rid of the Yair Lapid, Naftali Bennett coalition, which he might frankly be able to do. Before he left, he sort of was making some Trumpy noises about this is the scam of the century and so forth. Notably, he dropped that right before he actually left. He dropped that language. His exit concession speech was bellicose, but it wasn't anti-democratic. What he said was, I'm going into the opposition and I'm going to fight like heck not to have to stay there, which is a normal thing to say.
So, Jen, what do we know about Israel's new prime minister?
Well, it's Naftali Bennett. As we said, he is a far-right politician. He made his fortune in the tech industry. He's a millionaire, though he has said, you know, that after everything that, you know, at the end of the day, his kids will still have to work, as he's joked. So he's not, you know, we're not talking Jeff Bezos level here. He's a bit of a contradiction in terms, right? So he headed a settler movement, but he also doesn't live in a settlement. He lives in Tel Aviv. He is very much this kind of young, dynamic, new face of the right. That line that we heard Bibi Netanyahu say a second ago, my friends on the genuine right, that was a direct kind of dig at Naftali Bennett. Naftali Bennett has kind of framed himself as the face of the new, young, more dynamic right wing. We are the new face of the right wing party. Bennett used to be essentially a protege of Netanyahu's till they had a bit of a political falling out. I've spent time around Naftali Bennett in person, and he's very charismatic, even though I deeply disagree with his politics and pretty much every level. He's very dynamic as an individual, and you could see the kind of attraction. He, you know, during a previous Israeli election, had these really kind of funny, hipster, joking commercial ads for his campaign. And so he's very much trying to kind of say that Netanyahu is the old school, I'm the new school, I'm here to represent the new right. And that is threatening to Netanyahu.
And just 3 days in the new term as prime minister, Bennett ordered airstrikes into Gaza. That's the first military action against the Palestinian territory since a ceasefire was struck almost a month ago. And then late last night, a second airstrike was launched. David, what happened?
Well, this was a kind of three-part event. It began with a march by nationalists, some of them extremists, shouting death to Arabs, who marched as they do every year to remember the capture of East Jerusalem in the war of 1967. It's always been seen as a big provocation by both Palestinians and Israeli Arabs. That then led, as has happened in previous years, to Hamas militants letting go some incendiary balloons just over the border in Gaza, which land and cause brush fires. Then there's airstrikes. So you could have listeners kind of shrugging and saying, so there were no casualties. These are sort of fire balloons. There was an airstrike that didn't kill anyone. Same old, same old. But I do think that the fact that the new foreign minister, who is the centrist Yair Lapid, who will be the alternative prime minister if the government lasts that long, the fact that he called out the extremists waving Israeli flags who began this by shouting death to Arabs as they staged this triumphal march, that shows you how politics has changed with this new government. Because don't forget, there's now an Arab-Israeli party in the coalition, this extraordinarily broad coalition. And that reminds you that although ultra-Orthodox have enormous power in the Netanyahu years, they're only 12% of the population. 20% of the Israeli population are Arab Israelis who have never been represented in government before. So
that's,
I think that
point,
although this kind of this brief flare-up of kind of violence looks like same old, same old, the roots of it and the response to the Israeli coalition couldn't be more different.
Ron heads to the polls today to vote for a new president. Some are, actually. Many Iranians say they're boycotting the vote. And the turnout could be as low as 41%. That's much lower than past elections. Jen, Iran's current president, Hassan Rouhani, is urging Iranians to vote. But why are so many boycotting?
Well, you know, even though the Iranian elections are more or less kind of rigged every time, in the sense that there is a guardian council who judge, you know, who is sufficiently loyal to the supreme leader and they decide who can and can't run, this time around it was kind of even extra rigged. They basically got rid of any candidate who could potentially contest, who is now the frontrunner, Ibrahim Raisi. He is basically the choice of the supreme leader. He's his longtime protege. And they, you know, the supreme leader and his cronies very much want Raisi to be in the president's seat, but he previously lost to Rouhani. So they basically wanted to make sure that that doesn't happen again. And they cleared out the field. And the problem is that everyone knows this. And so, you know, even the IRGC, the Quds Force, the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, even they kind of called it out saying, this seems a little illegitimate, I don't know. So when they're complaining, you know there's a problem.
Yeah.
And so Iranians are aware, and they're like, look, we're not going to bother, this is ridiculous. The problem is that that is a problem for Khamenei, because he needs a bit of that veneer of democratic legitimacy, if it's fake.
So on Monday, China flew 28 warplanes into Taiwan-controlled airspace. That is the biggest action of its kind since the Taiwanese government began publishing information about the frequent incursions last year. David, it is very clear that this rattled Taipei. What was the point of this? What was China's message or their goal?
So China spent the whole of last year doing these sorties. It's not actually airspace controlled by Taiwan. That would be a kind of almost an act of war. This is lots of countries, including America, have these air defense air defense identification zones, where basically a foreign airplane that comes into it is subject to being questioned, may get fighters scrambled to just watch what it's doing. And the Chinese in 2020 flew 320 of these sorties. That's the highest tempo since the mid-1990s. What they're trying to do is to wear down the Taiwanese military, literally wear out some of their airplanes that keep getting scrambled. It costs them a fortune. It exhausts their pilots. The Taiwanese military is much smaller than the Chinese military. More importantly, China is trying to do two things. It's trying to threaten Taiwan. This is always linked to events in the outside world. This most recent one was linked to the G7 and NATO summits criticizing China. But it's also designed to create this idea of a new normal where Chinese warplanes are flying around Taiwan all the time, just kind of wear down the idea that Taiwan is a separate entity and to make kind of clear that China thinks this is all its space. And that feeds into concerns on the American side that China is getting ready for one day feeling that it's strong enough to try and take Taiwan over.
Which means we should probably prepare to see more of these kinds of actions. But let's move to North Korea, which seems to be bracing itself for a food crisis in the months ahead. State news media reported Wednesday that the country's leader, Kim Jong-un, had issued a rare warning about a, quote, tense food situation brought about by extensive flooding, the coronavirus pandemic, and international sanctions. End quote. And is it unusual for Kim Jong-un to go public on the international stage with these kind of details?
Yeah, in a word, quite unusual. North Korea is not able to feed itself, has not been able to feed itself really ever. And in the past, you know, it has taken food charity from China and, frankly, from the United States and from lots of other countries for whom grain shipments and other kinds of food assistance to North Korea was a way to inaugurate some diplomacy, to talk to North Korea about its weapons programs. And its threats against South Korea, principally, in a friendlier context. I think, you know, when Kim Jong-un is saying that he's not going to be able to provide for his people, it is a remarkable admission of the fact that, you know, that he has weaknesses. I mean, the North Korean leadership is essentially a cult in which the leader is absolutely inviolable, almost a godlike figure. And for that leader to say, hey, look, this isn't going to work, for a variety of reasons, not my fault, but, you know, this isn't going to work, and we're going to need some help, is pretty remarkable. I think the next thing we may see is a discussion of what kind of international food assistance might be feasible.
So, Jen, what does the intelligence community say about this? Do we have from intelligence any better details about what is going on inside North Korea?
Yeah, well, you know, it's obviously very opaque, right? We don't have a lot of international ambassadors there in normal times. So especially after the pandemic, a lot of, you know, ambassadors and embassy staff from countries that do maintain a presence there have left. We have heard some from the Russian ambassador there saying that he hasn't seen anything specifically in Pyongyang, but obviously, maybe it's not obvious, but Pyongyang is kind of the showcase. That's where the international community, if it does come to North Korea, gets to go see. So it's kind of a bit of a Potemkin village, if you will, and make sure that everyone there is at least well-fed, whereas in the rural areas, there may be, you know, potentially famine. It's difficult, right? The intelligence community often uses things like satellite imagery to look at fields that are flooded, to look at what, you know, the grain situation actually looks like on the ground. The UN Food Assistance kind of office has put together a report saying that it looks like they are short of roughly 2 months worth of food supplies. So it does seem to be that there is a significant food shortage. Just how significant is the question, and what this will mean for the North Korean regime is always kind of an open question. But, you know, we are seeing a lot of opacity. I think that's a contradiction in terms, but there is a lot of opacity also in terms of just the economic situation, but also what's going on inside the regime right now.
Great reference to a Potemkin village. If any of our listeners missed that reference, a Potemkin village is basically a construction, which is a facade. It's a fake facade made to look like things are absolutely okay. And David, I wonder if this could impact China in any way, or what you expect China's response would be to this announcement from North Korea about a possible food shortage.
So China's top priority is always stability. China's great fear is to have chaos and the collapse of the North Korean regime, and to have a reunification under chaotic conditions, which end up with a pro-American Korea right up to China's border, and in their worst nightmares, sort of American troops in Oakley sunglasses on the border,
aviator
looking at
sunglasses,
China.
David.
That's the Air Force, I think.
Yeah.
So they would stand ready to send lots of food. They have in the past sent enormous amounts of food, but one of the other disasters happening at the moment is that North Korea claims it has not had a single case of COVID. Nobody believes them. It has no health service that can really cope with this outside the most elite areas of the bigger cities like Pyongyang. And so there is a suspicion that there may be a COVID pandemic underway that they are lying about, saying doesn't exist. What we do know is that last year, Kim Jong-un, the leader, said that he was not going to allow anything, food aid, into the country because the borders had to be closed to prevent COVID coming in. So we have unfortunately seen, you know, in the 1990s when I first visited North Korea, they had millions of people die in a famine. This is a country that is, in order to maintain its hold over this, as Anne says, this cult-like hermit kingdom, they will let people die of hunger rather than bend in any way ideologically. And so something really awful might be about to happen between late summer and the autumn when the next harvest may come in.
Let's move to Hong Kong next. 500 police officers searched the newspaper offices of Apple Daily. They arrested five senior executives Thursday. And this is the second time local police have targeted that paper under China's new security law. Last year, police arrested and detained the paper's founder, Jimmy Lai. I wonder, David, if you can tell us a little bit more about the significance of the Apple Daily and what we know so far about this latest incident.
Look, it's the latest real kind of hammer blow against everything we used to know about Hong Kong. You know, I'm based here in mainland China in Beijing. You know, you would go down to Hong Kong until kind of really late 2019. It was the one place where you could speak freely. There was no censorship on the internet. You could interview people without fear of looking over your shoulder. Then they had those protests. Your listeners will remember in the summer of 2019. They responded by saying this was the West trying to undermine Hong Kong and China. They passed a draconian national security law in 2020. And this raid on the newspaper is the latest sign that they're willing to use that to crush everything that we used to know about the freedoms of Hong Kong inherited from the British days when it was handed back in 1997. And so this raid was the second raid. Apple Daily is a kind of raucous tabloid. It does a lot of kind of stuff that's pretty trashy, but it has also been a very feisty critic of the government. It also stands up for democracy. The Chinese absolutely hate Jimmy Lai, its wealthy owner. They've got him in prison now. On 20 months in prison for attending some peaceful protests, street protests. He's also facing other charges. This is, the drama of this is extraordinary. So the newspaper printed an extra massive run. People were buying copies of that to show it's one of the only last safe ways of showing opposition to the Chinese government was to buy a copy of the newspaper. 500,000 copies sold today in Hong Kong.
Let's take a listen. Here is Hong Kong National Security Unit Senior Superintendent Steve Lee. He spoke to reporters Wednesday and gave this reason for these arrests.
Over 30 pieces of the articles, which is request the foreign countries to impose the sanction to the Hong Kong and the people of the Republic of China. And we have a very strong evidence that the questionable articles is a play a very crucial part for the conspiracy, which provides the ammunition for the foreign countries to impose the sanctions to Hong Kong and the peoples of the Republic of China.
So, David, how are we to interpret that? Does that mean China thinks this newspaper is a threat to national security?
It knows it's not, but this is about chilling all protests and opposition in Hong Kong. So the charge is that actually before the law was even passed, so this is a law being used retroactively, which is an outrageous thing, they published articles saying the government is behaving so badly that countries like America should think about sanctioning Hong Kong and saying that Hong Kong is no longer separate from the mainland. That is now a serious criminal offence under the national security law. And there's a bit of that clip that you didn't have time to play. The same national security police officer was asked about whether people in Hong Kong, if they shared the same articles on their social media, on their Facebook or something, were they in breach of the national security law? And he said, I would strongly advise people as a law enforcer, do not draw suspicion to yourself. It is not something you wish to spread. So if you live in Hong Kong and you want to repost one of those articles on Facebook, the National Security Police are telling you that you're drawing suspicion to yourself. It could not be more sinister.
I wonder, Anne, before we leave Hong Kong, what have we heard from the Biden administration about their support for Hong Kong? What has Biden said?
Well, you know, it's funny, Celeste. He hasn't said a great deal about Hong Kong. I mean, the most thuggish Chinese moves came before Biden had taken office. But his administration has said that, you know, the U.S. will always try to stand up for human rights and justice in Hong Kong. But they know that there's, practically speaking, very little that they can do. That isn't rhetorical. It's different than Taiwan, right? I mean, yeah. We sell arms to Taiwan. There's a whole separate operation that within the U.S. national security and government structure that is devoted to trying to help Taiwan be independent and stand up to China. None of that is available in the case of Hong Kong. So it's really just saying, calling it out, which Biden has done to a degree. I think Secretary of State Antony Blinken has gone much further. But, you know, they're mindful of their own limitations. I will say that Hong Kong is one of the rights abuses in Hong Kong is one of the things that the Biden administration regularly lists when it talks about its list of complaints about Chinese behavior. Most of the rest of the things that it talks about have some direct bearing on the United States. But in that case, it's just saying that China should not be doing what it is doing in Hong Kong.
So, but Jennifer, has the Biden administration said anything about supporting free press in Hong Kong? Because Biden has tried to make a real distinction between his approach to free press as opposed to his predecessor, Trump.
Right. You know, Biden has obviously taken a very different rhetorical approach toward the press. He's said that you are the smartest people. But he also, interestingly, had a bit of run-ins with the press during his trip. I'm sure Anne can probably speak more to this, but there were some rough incidents. At one point, you know, Russian thugs were essentially roughing up the press, trying to get into the Biden-Putin meeting, and Biden just kind of sat there smiling. He had a unfortunate and sort of rude approach to a journalist who was asking a very legitimate question. At one point, he during the press conferences had a list of journalists who wouldn't really call on people beyond that list. So having that kind of happen to me was a bit stark at the same time that he's sitting next to Putin, who's known for jailing journalists. At the same time, you know, we just now see this raid on the free press. So I personally, as a journalist, you know, would love to see a little bit more full-throated support for the press, not just in rhetoric, but in action from the Biden administration. I think many journalists would like to see that. Rhetoric is great, but how you treat your own press is also something that the world will watch.
David, I wonder if we could talk about China and climate policy, especially since you just wrote a recent article for The Economist on that, because there are questions being raised on the international stage about how sincere China may be when it comes to climate change. What is China's policy here?
So China's climate policies could not matter more. One, because China is the world's largest polluter by far, larger than America, Russia, and India put together. But also because every time someone like President Biden lists the things that he thinks he can work with China on, climate is very high on the list, because unless countries like America and China get together and try and solve this, the world can't be saved from climate change. The problem is that although the Chinese leader Xi Jinping has said some very ambitious things that made all the right noises about climate, the actions on the ground at the moment are really ambiguous. So Xi says that he's going to become that carbon emissions are going to peak around 2030. That's not early enough. And that he's going to go carbon neutral by 2060. In the meantime, they are still building enormous coal-fired power stations, still get more than half of the electricity where I am in China from coal. And I did a column for The Economist this week looking at how foreigners can play a small but potentially significant role, because you have a whole bunch of multinational companies that make a lot of stuff in China, and they have promised to go carbon neutral around the whole world with their whole supply chain. And you've had some really famous companies, particularly Europeans, saying to the mayors of Chinese cities, if you want me to expand my factory or build a new factory and you keep selling me coal-fired power, I can't do it because that's going to break all of our global promises. And so on their own, foreign companies aren't big enough to make that change. But you see that potentially it that's one of the things that could nudge them towards a kind of tipping point.
David Rennie, Beijing bureau chief for The Economist. Also Jennifer Williams, senior foreign editor of Vox, also co-host of Vox's foreign affairs podcast, Worldly. And Anne Guerin is the White House correspondent with a focus on foreign policy and national security for The Washington Post. Thanks to everyone for joining us. 1A's lead audio engineer and sound designer is Jake Cherry. He gets technical assistance from Rashad Young. Aileen Humphreys is the producer and editor of 1A On Demand. Barb Anguiano produces our podcast. Chris Castano is our digital editor. 1A's senior producer is Jonquilin Hill. And Paige Osborne is our managing producer. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Celeste Headlee. This is 1A.